Welcome you all to the second general session, California Council of the Blind. And I want, yes indeed, and I want to have you all give a warm welcome to a gentleman who needs no introduction, Convention Committee Chair and First Vice President, and a man without whom I would just not have enough hours in the day to get everything done, Eugene Lozano. Eugene.
Thank you very much for those kind words and the trust that you and the organization have instilled upon me. I hope that you will find this to be a very informative evening session. It's going to be very full with a lot of different topics, and that you'll be able to maintain your attention because afterwards nominations committee meets. So keep that in mind. Okay. I would like to ask if Rob Turner could please come to the head table.
He's here.
Yes, I'm here.
Good. I would like for Rob to provide us with a credentials report. Provide instructions on how he would like people to respond.
Well, thank you. I'll make this quick. This is the way we seat chapters. We have to be able to represent their membership at the conventions. So we go through a process of determining the number of members and the number of votes and so forth. And it's a great way for ACB to stay democratic. So let's just get started. I've got the ACB Capital Chapter, President Paul Patchy, 41 members, 8 votes. Joni Patchy, Delegate Joni Patchy, Alt Norma Guerrero, nominating Paul Patchy. Next, Active Blind Inland Valleys Chapter, President Nellie Emerson. Okay, 14 members, 5 votes. Nancy Unger, delegate, no alternate, nominating Nancy Unger. Alameda County Chapter, President Rose Harder, 16 members, 5 votes. Katrina McCurdy is the delegate, Alt Rose Harder, and the nominating is Rose Harder. Next, we move to the Association for Multicultural Concerns, AMC, President Lillian Scafey, 48 members, 5 votes. Lewis Preston, delegate, no alternate, nominating Lewis Preston. Next, Bayview Chapter, President Steve Fort, 60 members, 12 votes. Delegate, Steve Fort, alternate, Kathy Skivers, nominating Steve Fort. Next, Blind Students of California, President Sean Ryan, 6 members, 5 votes. It's a state affiliate. Delegate, Sean Ryan. Alternate, none. Nominating, Sean Ryan. Braille Revival League of California, BRLC, President Marlene O'Neill, 42 members, 5 votes, statewide affiliate. The delegate, Marlene O'Neill. Alternate, Roger Peterson. Nominating, Marlene O'Neill. Butte County Chapter, Al Beagler, President. 10 members, 5 votes. The delegate is Joanne Beagler, Alt, Al Beagler. And nominating is also Al Beagler. California Council of Citizens with Low Vision, CCLV, LV. Bernice Kandarian, president. 80 members, 5 votes. It's a statewide affiliate. Donna Sanchez, delegate, alternate. Bernice Kandarian. Nominating committee, Bernice Kandarian. California Library Users of, I'm sorry, yes, of America, Kahlua. Jerry Arakawa, president. 26 members, 5 votes, a statewide affiliate. Jerry Arakawa, delegate. Leslie, alternate, Leslie Tom, nominating Jerry Arakawa. Now, the California School for the Blind Alumni Association, basically CSB alum, Elmer Chapson and Al Gill could not make it to the convention, so Josie Conklin is going to be the delegate. She's here. That's great. And she'll also be on the nominating committee. Next, we have the Central Coast Low Vision Council, CCLVC. President, Michelle Mason. 15 members, 5 votes. Michelle Mason, delegate. Alt, Denise Martinez. Nominating, Michelle Mason. East Los Angeles Chapter. President, Louis Herrera. 28 members, 6 votes. Delegate, Ramona Craig. Alternate, Louis Herrera. Nominating, Ramona Craig. Glendale Burbank Chapter. Artis Bazin, president. 31 members, 6 votes. Delegate, Keith Johnson. Alternate, Debbie Rogers. Nominating, Keith Johnson. Golden Gate Chapter. President, Martin Jones. 30 members, 6 votes. Delegate, Dr. Martin Jones. Alternate is Marvelena Quesada. And Dr. Jones is the nominating committee rep. Greater Bakersfield Council, President John Ross, 19 members, 5 votes. Delegate, Brandy Morgan. Alternate, Penny Valdovinos. And nominating, Penny Valdovinos. Did I say that right? Yeah. Well, okay, good. Now, here we go. Let's see. Greater Long Beach Chapter, President Robert Wendt. Members, 25 votes, 5. Delegate Robert Wendt. Alt, Aisha McKinney Wendt. Robert Wendt, nominating. Greater Los Angeles Chapter, Pamela Hill Metz, President. 23 members, 5 votes. Delegate, Ken Metz. Alternate, Penny Frazier. Nominating committee, Ken Metz. Greater San Joaquin Valley Chapter, Mary Beth Randall, President. Members, 20 votes, 5. The delegate, Mary Beth Randall. Alt, Tom Randall. Nominating, Tom Randall. Guide Dog Users of California, GDUC. President Ann Kaiser. 55 members, 5 votes, a statewide affiliate. Delegate, Lorraine Foster. Alt, Mary Beth Randall. Nominating, Mary Beth Randall. High Desert Chapter, and I don't think anyone is going to be here because I know Dominic and is Brad here? No. So they're not going to be here. I hadn't known for sure, so we'll just
Dominic is ill.
Yes, so we'll just put them as not attending. Yes, okay. So they are not attending the convention. The Humboldt chapter, I've got President James Forbes, 20 members, 5 votes. Now, I don't think Jill O'Connell is here, is she? Okay, but James is that right? Well,
we haven't seen him yet.
I've been waiting. I don't know whether I kept hearing he was going to be here, so I assumed that he could be seated. But he's not here, and I haven't heard from him up at this point, so I think it's have to be another one that will be not attending. So that's Humboldt that will not be attending. And I'm okay. Inland Empire chapter, President Foster Brown, 32 members, 6 votes, delegate Bessie Dunn, alternate Foster Brown, nominating Bessie Dunn. Orange County chapter, President Catherine Schmidt Whitaker, 26 members, 5 votes, delegate Bonnie Rennie, alternate Bob Rennie, nominating Bonnie Rennie. Orientation Center for the Blind Alumni, David Jackson, 25 members, 5 votes, a statewide affiliate, delegate David Jackson, no alternate, nominating David Jackson. Pyramid Chapter, President Onetta Sally, 14 members, 5 votes, delegate Onetta Sally. Is she here?
I don't think so.
Okay. Anybody here from Compton? I'm sorry, from Pyramid. I don't think they're attending either. So, again, we've got to mark them down as not attending. I like to give them to the last minute. Randolph Shepherd, Vendors of California, RSVC, David Hanlon, President, 20 members, 5 votes, a statewide affiliate, Delegate David Hanlon, Alt Roy Harmon, nominating David Hanlon. Redwood Empire Chapter, President Beryl Brown, 46 members, 9 votes. Delegate William Gillespie, Alt Eric Smiley, nominating Eric Smiley. San Bernardino Chapter, President Alan Ramos, 24 members, 5 votes. Delegate Alan Ramos, Alt None, nominating Alan Ramos. San Diego Braille Club, President Jacqueline Jackson, 20 members, 5 votes. Delegate Jacqueline Jackson, alternate Monique McCorley, nominating Jacqueline Jackson. San Diego Chapter, President Jerry Wilson, 32 members, 6 votes. Delegate Doug Martin, alternate Allison Andrews, nominating Doug Martin. San Francisco Chapter, President Linda Perel, 33 members, 7 votes. Delegate Frank Welty, alternate Linda Perel, nominating Linda Perel. San Gabriel Valley Chapter, President Donna Pomerantz, members 49, 10 votes. Vincent Calderon, delegate. Alt Pat LaFrance Wolf, nominating Donna Pomerantz. Silicon Valley Council of Blind, SVCB. President, Mike Keithley. 70 members, 14 votes. Delegate, Lorraine Brown. Alternate, Mike Keithley. Nominating, Roger Peterson. And Solano Adult Blind Club. That is Roseanne McLaughlin, president. 15 members, 5 votes. The delegate, Diane Phelps. No alt. No nominating rep. San Mateo chapter. That's 50 members, 10 votes. Delegate, Jeannie Ackerman. No alt. Jeannie Ackerman nominating.
Sure, there's no voting tonight. I don't need
that. Okay.
No voting.
And again, we have not attending. We've got Antelope Valley. And Compton, El Dorado, and High Desert, and we said Humboldt, and Pyramid. Thank you. And that concludes my report. Thank you. I want to thank Steve Fort, too, for being on the committee, and that's my report.
Alan Ramos is in Arkansas taking training.
Oh, okay. Well, that's we're going to have to strike them from the list, too. I apologize. I thought that I'd heard that they were here, so we will add them to the list of not attending. And I thank you for bringing that to my attention.
I will entertain a motion to adopt the Credentials Committee's report. Is there a second? Okay, there's a second. Discussion? Yes, Rhonda King.
I just want to ask you a question. I believe it's Blind Students of California kids. And I believe I heard somebody say that they were going to be.
Yeah, BSC. That's what I've been. Yes.
Mr. President, they're now up to 12. They're now up to 12, right?
Good, good.
Oh, it's 12?
Yes.
Good.
Okay, not 6.
I don't know when that changed. Maybe my figures were reported before they added the new members.
And plus it was 14 last year at one point, so it hasn't been below. Yeah.
Okay, any those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Nays? Abstentions. The ayes have it. Thank you.
Thank you.
But you'll need that for nominating.
Yes, I will.
We have already, believe it or not, already started to get behind, but I would like to make a few opening comments before we introduce our first speaker of the evening. As the chair of the convention committee, one of the responsibilities that the committee has is to try to find out from the membership topics that they would like heard during the general session. One of those that repeatedly have come up from members is to regularly receive updates on new therapies related to eye diseases and other related medical conditions. In light of this, and having the opportunity of having one of the largest medical centers in California and possibly this country here in the Sacramento area, we were fortunate enough to bring our next speaker, and And this is due to the efforts of one of our members, Carmen Quintana, and her daughter, Maria Quintana. Maria is a registered nurse at the UC Davis Medical Center in the Department of Ophthalmology, and she was able to help us find our next speaker. And I want to thank the Quintana family for their assistance. Our speaker received a combined medical degree and PhD in 1999 from the University of Minnesota Medical Scientist Training Program. This program is in the city, the campus in Minneapolis. He's currently employed as an assistant professor of clinical ophthalmology in the Department of Ophthalmology and Vision Science at UC Davis Medical Center here in Sacramento. He has done extensive research, and he will be talking about his research, so I will skip over that for now. With the time that he has committed to his research, teaching, and his family, he finds some time to do volunteer work in the community. He works in a low-cost clinic to do with eye conditions. He has become the chair of the Vision Walk here in Sacramento, put on by the Foundation on Fighting Blindness, that will take place on June 14th of this year. In the past, he has volunteered to do retinal care in Mexico and India, has participated in a mentoring program for inner city youth. I would like to ask that we give a warm welcome to Dr. David T. Lander.
Thank you very much. It's a real honor and a privilege to be here tonight with you. It's a great chance to talk to you a little bit about my favorite subject, which is retinal disease. I specialize just in the retina. I know it's hard to believe you can specialize in just one tiny little layer of the human body, but it's true, you can. And not just the right eye or the left. Actually do both eyes, so that's nice. I did part of my training in Minnesota, of course, and then went to UCLA, and now I've been here for several years enjoying UC Davis. I want to tell you a little bit about what I think where we are now, some of the great advances that have happened even in the past several years, and then kind of the things I think that are right on the near horizon and not too distant future for treatments and only on retinal disease. First of all, vision loss is becoming an increasingly significant part of our population. Vision loss is approximately 1 to 3% of our population has severe vision loss, and even by the year 2020, it's thought to increase by 70%, that the percentage of people affected by severe vision loss will increase that much. And largely that's because people are living longer, and there's a lot of cures for other problems, and vision loss then manifests itself more. Where are the successes today? There's a lot of successes today. There's the biggest one to talk about is a medical retina. The medical retina means that we have new medicines, pharmacologic treatments that help retinal disease. That was something when I started training, which actually isn't that long ago, there wasn't really much talked about. But now there's been a real explosion in terms of certain medicines that help the retina. So what do I mean by that? Well, first of all, we've learned even that nutrition makes a big difference for the retina. For macular degeneration, a large study was done called the AREDS study, and that was the first significant national trial that showed vitamins made any difference for eye conditions. And in that study, they found antioxidants make a big difference. Vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc, beta carotene. These vitamins made a significant difference. Now, it didn't reverse the problem, and it didn't improve the problem, but it slowed down the problem. So that was the first encouragement to us that actually nutrition and what we eat does make a difference on our vision. Where are these antioxidants found? They're found in the foods you've been told all your life are good for you, the fruits, the vegetables, the things you didn't want to eat when you were little. Those are proving to be true, that they are good for your retina, and largely because they're good for the blood vessels of the retina. So the retina is exquisitely sensitive to anything that damages the little blood vessels. So the retina is vascularized by small capillaries, and these capillaries are very, very sensitive to high sugars. They're very, very sensitive to smoking. They're very, very sensitive to diets that don't have antioxidants. And all these things are why the retina is injured by things like diabetes, high blood pressure, macular degeneration, which is advanced by smoking and things like that. So in addition to nutrition, a molecule is discovered called VEGF. And VEGF is a molecule that cells make when they are stressed. And VEGF causes blood vessels to grow. And the only reason I tell you about this molecule is because it's become one of our main targets for retinal disease. When we learn to turn off VEGF, we stop a lot of retinal disease. So what am I talking about? Well, macular degeneration gets worse when it becomes wet. So a lot of people lose vision because it goes from dry to wet. And that is because the blood vessels grow in response to a molecule, the VEGF molecule. Diabetes itself also gets worse when blood vessels grow and leak, and that too is caused by this molecule called VEGF. Little babies that are born prematurely, that are born maybe a month or 2 months early before they should be, their blood vessels are stressed, and they may start growing the wrong direction, and that is also caused by VEGF. All the babies that go blind from being born too early is again caused by this VEGF. And the list actually goes on from there. That's not the beginning. The understanding of how these blood vessels cause trouble for the retina is very big, and until 4 or 5 years ago, we didn't know how to do anything about it. But now there's molecules that stop that can absorb this molecule, that can turn it off, and so we're learning a lot about that. So before that, we had no treatment for the wet type of macular degeneration. Before that, we had no treatment for diabetes besides the laser treatment. And so now we have kind of a whole new arsenal of treatments that turn this molecule off, that decrease it, and we hope even can allow some reversal of vision for people. So for wet macular degeneration, instead of everybody getting worse, we actually now see 90% of people stabilized with treatment and 30% improving. So that's a miracle step forward for us for something that never had a treatment. The treatments go also have increased in surgery. So our surgeries have improved. We have new instruments that allow us to access the surface of the retina easier, that allow us to treat the eye more gently than we used to treat it. We have these smaller instruments. They're 25-gauge. 25-gauge instruments are very, very small, smaller than a piece of spaghetti that we're using to operate inside the eye. And with several of these tiny little instruments, we're able to gently repair retinas that have been detached, retinas that have macular degeneration, retinas that have fibrosis from diabetes. All these problems we are much more able to address with that advancement. So what is my area? What am I interested in? Well, I'll talk mostly about that, and I'll talk a little bit about the areas that I'm not focused on. But I think stem cells and cell therapies are a real area of promise for retinal problems. The retina has several cell layers, and sometimes it's single layers of the retina are that have trouble. For example, in cone dystrophy, which is a retinal degeneration that causes loss of central vision, it's often just the cone cells, which are photoreceptor cells, that quit working. And why do they quit working? Well, one of their proteins has a DNA change that causes it to fold abnormally. And for some reason, it works for quite a while for a person's life, but then it may stop working. And then these cells, after years of working for a person, suddenly no longer can cope with this protein that's malformed. In other words, it's folded in a funny configuration. And when that happens in the cells, that group of cells quit working, and the person with a cone dystrophy would lose their central vision. If it's a rod dystrophy, that's retinitis pigmentosa, it's the cells then in the peripheral vision that go first, and then it often advances to affect the cells in the center as well. In both of these types, it's this one layer of the retina. The retina has six layers, and it's just this bottom layer, the photoreceptor, that normally captures light and then sends an electrical signal to the brain. That's how we see. And when you lose that one layer of cells, then it no longer works. You have to have all the components of your eye to see. So cell therapy, I think, is a real potential, because it could potentially both rescue this layer of cell and potentially even replace this layer of cells. Cell therapy, what do I mean by that? Cell therapy is when you take cells and you use them as a vehicle to treat a condition. So how could that be used? Well, you could think of it as a Trojan horse. The cells could be placed in a place that they need to deliver something. So if there's a growth factor or a protein that's missing, these cells could then deliver this protein as a little factory. In other words, you put them in and they act as a little factory and they deliver what's missing. How else could they be helpful? Well, some cells just really want to be touched by another healthy cell to stay healthy. They need that, what we call cell-cell interaction. They actually need a physical touch of another cell. And so providing this nourishing cell might actually provide that touch that this other cell needs to stay alive, to stay healthy. The third way is probably the way most of us think of it. Well, just, you know, I have many of my patients come in, can't you just take out that old thing and give me the new one? You know, that's what they want. So that's the third way. Maybe the cells could actually just be replace the ones that have been missing. Now, your eye has 1.5 million connections from areas of your retina to the brain. And those 1.5 million connections are all arranged in a way that your brain can understand it. So it knows that light hitting one part means something different than light hitting another part. So for us to just replace the whole eye becomes very complicated, because we'd have to rehook up 1.5 million different little connections in the correct orientation for a person to make sense of what they're seeing. Some people argue you may be able to relearn how to see, but it would be a very hard process, especially for an adult. So the advantage of cell therapy is potentially you can replace the cell layer below the connections. So the connections are actually above these cells I'm talking about. And so that's why we think this cell therapy would be very promising. Has cell therapy been done, or is it being done already? Sure, it's been done since the 60s for bone marrow. People, as you well know, have had bone marrow stem cell transplants from themselves, from other people. They've repopulated their whole immune system. So it's not something that's new and crazy. It's something that's already being done and very, very helpful for lots of people for stem cells in that area. Even in the eye itself, the cornea has certainly been transplanted, but the stem cells that supply the cornea have also been transplanted. We call it a certain name, but it has there's a certain set of cells that live right on the side of the cornea, and they grow. They provide cells that grow over the surface of your cornea. The cornea is like the windshield of your eye, and if it's not clear, you can't see. So these cells kind of do keep that job clear. They're the windshield wipers that keep the cornea clear. And so it's already been done for that. But the retina so far to date has not been successfully treated with cells. But certainly that is our hope, and I think that it's not in the distant future. But it's not for lack of trying. It's stem cells have been isolated from the brain, from the retina, from the bone marrow, and all have been placed in the retina, under the retina, over the retina, and we have seen survival of the cells. So certainly cells can be put there and survive. But that's where we come into problems. The cells haven't integrated. So I think the main problems are number one, migration. The cells don't move appropriately where we really want them to go. Number two, they don't necessarily integrate. What does that mean? Well, that means they don't join up with their partners in the way we'd like them to join up. They don't shake hands with everybody the way we want them to. So they don't necessarily bind to the photoreceptor or the cell above it or the cell below it in the correct manner that's really helpful. So that's the third problem. And the fourth problem we worry about is that they don't stay there long enough. So they may die out. Why would that be? Well, certainly the cell just may be challenged by the environment. It doesn't have enough nourishment, or it's getting the same signals the other ones had that killed it. Or that they're actually being rejected by the immune system. The immune system does mostly ignore the eye, but it certainly is able to mount attacks on the eye. It's certainly if something's foreign there. And so those are our four main obstacles are those four things. But they're certainly not insurmountable obstacles, and I think there's something we'll see advancement in the near future. There is one study out just this last year and a half now, in the RCS mouse. And the RCS rat has RPE 65 damage. That's a protein, if that's common in Leber's congenital amaurosis. So those are children born without vision, and it's because they are missing a protein called RPE65. And when you replace it in this, when you give these animals stem cells, these rats go from not being able to see to being able to see. And they are able to provide it at different steps. They are able to provide it not only during development, which might make sense if you give it to the animal while they're developing, they reverse their vision. But even later than that, they're able to provide the cells and the vision reversed. So that is certainly very encouraging data. You may have heard of the Briard dog, the one who had had gene therapy for a similar problem, and this is the most exciting gene therapy we've seen related to eye disease, and that's a dog that went from not being able to see to being able to see because they replaced that single protein. Lancelot, I believe, was the name of the dog that first got it, so he's now able to run around and see after having that treatment. So we're certainly encouraged. That's just one problem and one protein, and we need to understand more to be able to treat people that have lots of different problems. At UC Davis, we've been very involved in many of these areas. There's a new trial we've started looking at new vitamins. So we've all heard of the ones I mentioned before, but as you may have yourself, people wonder what about lutein? What about zeaxanthin? What about omega-3 fatty acids? What about, as you know, there's a long list of different herbs and medicines that may be beneficial or may not be. So there's a new study we're looking at, the ones we think are most promising, which are zeaxanthin, lutein, and omega-3 fatty acids. We're also looking at using VEGF, this molecule I mentioned before, trying to turn it off for diabetes. And in diabetics, people who have diabetes, the retina certainly likes not having that molecule around. So when we treat the people with it, we see benefit. The real question is, does it provide long-term benefit, and does it help them functionally? We also we're in the process of trying to set up a stem cell clinical trial, and our first target will be occlusion of the retinal vessels. What's that mean? It's a stroke of the eye. So when someone has a loss of blood flow, the eye, like any part of the body, loses its function. And so our hope is to target that group of patients and actually see if these cells would allow improvement. The UC Davis has put a real significant investment in stem cells. There's, I think, over $12 million now recently raised to help investigators in all fields, from heart disease to skin disease to Parkinson's to Alzheimer's. There's a large group of researchers working on this. There's a new stem cell building being built, and it's thanks to yourselves, since you're taxpayers here, the Center for Regenerative Medicine, California Institute of Regenerative Medicine, has helped sponsoring the stem cell research. And why is that needed? Well, this type of building will allow us to do the translational work. What's that mean? How do you go from saying that this cell can potentially potentially help somebody, to actually being able to isolate them cleanly, use them and know that they're safe. Are they truly reliable? Do they reproducibly able to treat patients? That's called the hard work of going from the theory to the practice. And that's what we call the translational research. And so this building is really focused on allowing us to use and produce cells in a way that we'll actually be able to use them for patients reproducibly in large enough quantities, cleanly, make sure that they're not causing trouble, and make sure that they're doing what we hope them to do. I think there's hope in a lot of other areas. Well, let me mention one last thing. There's an exciting clinical trial that we've been a part of at UC Davis, and focused on retinitis pigmentosa. And it's been found for some time now that a molecule called CNTF is thought to stabilize and maybe reverse the health of the retina in people who have retinitis pigmentosa. So someone, Wang Tao is her name, who had a clever idea of trying to get cells to be the Trojan horse I mentioned before. So she, with a group of other people, put this protein into a cell and had the cell produce it like a small factory. And then the question is, how do you get it to the retina? So they had the idea to put these cells in a small capsule. And the capsule would have large enough holes so the protein would leak out, and large enough holes so oxygen and things could get in there and keep them alive, but not so big that the immune system would get in there and cause its trouble. So cells couldn't penetrate, and the cells actually couldn't leak out as well. So in this capsule, can be placed in the eye itself, right in the vitreous, sewed to the part to the side of the eye, and then those cells act as a small factory and just produce this protein over and over. So she did that, and it was very exciting that she tried several cell lines, and none would work. They kept putting them in the eye, and the cells died. So she tried cell line after cell line after cell line, and none of them seemed to work. And finally, she tried a cell line from a man here at UC Davis called Larry Yemelin. Now, Larry Yemelin lost his vision in graduate school and came here to do research, told he shouldn't because of his loss of vision, but he wisely didn't listen. And he went on and became the chair of biochemistry at UC Davis. And actually, his cells are the ones that she tried cell line number 60 for her. She decided to try his cell line, and is the one that actually worked. And these cells survived in the eye, and they're the ones that they've now placed into clinical trials. So it's now in stage 2 clinical trial, which we're privileged to be a part of. There's, I think, 16 centers around the country. And these cells are in this small capsule I described, producing this protein, which we think will keep the retina healthy and may reverse vision loss and also stabilize vision. So very exciting. It's been about 6 months now since I think, and patients are doing very well. We're still accumulating data, so probably a year from now we'll really know how effective it is. And it's certainly a great idea in terms of how to deliver protein and molecules to the retina. So that's a very exciting work. I think the future is very bright in many areas. We've all heard of artificial vision, which maybe seemed like pie in the sky in the past, but more and more there's four methods. One down in Los Angeles that seems to be very effective in terms of artificial vision, where they place electrodes stimulated by light on the retinal surface, and that simulates vision and the ganglion cells on the retina, which are the cells that give vision. Sorry, if that's me. those cells are stimulated and can reproduce vision in patients. And that may more and more, it's still in clinical trials now, but I think it will be a reality. As I mentioned earlier, I think gene therapy as well. As we learn more about each individual gene, we can learn to target those genes, and then we can learn to turn off and on certain genes, and that I think is going to be very, very helpful for people with retinal disease. And there's certainly a lot more areas I could go on and on about, and I don't know how long you have tonight, so I don't want to put you to sleep, but there's a large area, lots of research in retina, and a very exciting time. One last thing I want to mention is regarding the Vision Walk. Foundation Fighting Blindness has been an organization that's sponsored and focused really on retinal disease, and they've sponsored and been a part of many of the discoveries I mentioned and many untold research areas that I haven't mentioned. And this is their first fundraiser here in the Sacramento area. It's just a walk around Land Park. And if you're interested, I think there's a table here. And there's a website, www.visionwalk.org. Keep it easy so you can remember it. But if you're interested, certainly that's a worthwhile thing. So thank you for your attention, and thanks for letting me be a part of this. I think now I'll open up for some questions, if anybody has some.
Dr. Lander, this is Roger Peterson, and I have Leber's congenital amaurosis. My gene is AIPL1.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to make an observation that I hope will be here. I'd be interested in your comments. The politics of... anyway, the politics of vision research are such that on the one hand, we have the folks that say that we shouldn't care about vision research because blindness is just an inconvenience anyway, and vision researchers are bad guys, and all we should care about is, you know, getting more power for blind people. And, you know, there are some people in our organization probably that feel that way, and certainly in the other organization. On the other hand, we have the vision research and cure people who there might be some in an organization like Foundation Fighting Blindness that say that are into, you know, raising money for research and doing the cure, but they sometimes tend to be a little bit demeaning to blind people and say, pity these poor blind people, but blindness is an unmitigated disaster. And what I'm hoping, and I've been, you know, involved in some of the family conferences with Leber's congenital amaurosis and so forth with families, and I've been trying to draw the line between saying, I want to, and I hope this organization might do that too, I want to support vision research and be a part of it and push back the frontiers of knowledge, but at the same time try to convince the folks that are doing it not to insult blind people, not to say, oh, my God, blindness, oh, to, you know, that if you've got blindness, you still can live and all that kind of stuff. Comment, doctor?
Well, I think your point is great. I'm really glad you stood up and said that. Yeah, I think it's something that any research we need to be very well aware of, especially regarding blindness. And I wish many of my patients could hear you. I think some people fear blindness more than they should. But at the same time, I'm glad to see that we have treatments and ways to preserve, you know, vision for those that we can. So I think even a man like Dr. Yumlin himself, who shows it, that you can do many, if not everything, you want to do when you have some things that you don't, such as vision. So I think it's a point well taken, and I appreciate you saying that.
What are you doing as far as research pertaining to glaucoma and stem cells and things and such?
The question is, I think maybe you all heard it, is regarding stem cells and glaucoma. Glaucoma is a very active area of research because there's a lot of people affected by glaucoma. I personally am, as I said before, mostly focused on just the aspects of the retina. But saying that, our knowledge of how stem cells work, especially in Trojan horse method and things like that, a lot of glaucoma research now is focused on neuroprotection. In other words, we wonder why just the high pressure is damaging to these cells. Why does high pressure in the eye damage the nerve cells? And we're learning that that the nerve cells are exquisitely sensitive to that. And so that's brought up this whole area of neuroprotection. And we're learning that in some people, we may be able to increase that protection. In other words, make them less sensitive to this damage. And stem cells might be a mechanism to increase that neuroprotection. Certainly, many people are working on trying to allow the nerve itself to have recovery through stem cells. And that's similar to work to like spinal cord, another peripheral nervous system, where people are trying to allow the nerves to have, you know, improved function after injury. So I think in both those areas, there's a lot of research going on.
But no miracles for glaucoma has occurred yet, is what you're saying.
No, no miracle has occurred, but I think there's a lot of advance. So how soon will it be? I think if you ask any researcher, they always say like it's 5 to 7 years away. But I do think there will be true advances in probably in the next 5 to 7 years. I see a lot of preventative therapies that we've never had before. So
okay.
I think it's very encouraging.
Thank you.
We can take about two more questions. Who's the next person at the mic?
I have RP, and I was wanting to know how to get into the clinical trial.
A very good question. So how do people with RP get into clinical trials such as we talked about? I think the main thing is to stay connected with the doctor that you've been involved with for your vision. If you haven't been involved with somebody, certainly be seen. I mean, because the main things when I'm a researcher is trying to find the appropriate person. So not everybody fits into these categories we have for research, but many people do. And so it's through our connection with patients that allow us to put people into studies like the one I mentioned. So being evaluated, being seen by an ophthalmologist and a retina specialist, if it's RP, is the main way to get plugged in. The current study probably will have an opening in the next year for a phase 3 trial, but that's 6 months away before I'll know that.
I think there's several individuals, and the last person will be Rhonda, but there's some people in front of her. If they would go and speak, we won't be able to take any more questions after Rhonda. But who's the next person, Ed?
Okay. Hello. I was asking, I have optical neuropathy, which is damage to the optic nerve. And how is the stem cell research going as far as that particular issue is concerned?
It is very active. There's a lot of people, a lot of labs, a lot of centers focused on optic neuropathy and trying to restore function of the optic nerve. It is a very tricky problem because that's the conduit for the 1.5 million connections that I talked about. That's the freeway of all those connections. And being able to restore those cells means you have to allow the cell to travel all the way through that whole freeway from the brain all the way to the retina to recreate the connection that needs to be appropriate. So I think it is one of our harder tasks. I think it's, unfortunately, I think it's one of the things we'll learn later rather than earlier, but there's a lot of research in it because it's also the things that affect people with spinal cord injury because this is very similar to that and other peripheral nerve disease. So it's there's a large population of people studying it, large groups studying it. So I think there's real hope, and there's already a lot of advance to prevent loss. So the next question is, well, how can you recover loss? And I think that's our next moment.
Hello, it's Rhonda King.
Wait, I think there's somebody before you, Rhonda. No?
There's somebody before me?
Okay. Rhonda's the last one. Go ahead, Rhonda.
Okay. What I wanted to say is I was diagnosed in 1985 with retinitis pigmentosa. And in 1993, when I discovered the CCB, I met a lot of individuals with RP. And I heard a lot about tunnel vision. And so over the next 3 or 4 years, I tried finding a retina specialist or somebody who could send me through doing more tests because I've never had tunnel vision. And I tried explaining to them that I had lost my central vision first. All I had left was peripheral. So I had to go through all the tests again. And they finally diagnosed me with Stargardt, with retinitis pigmentosa features. And they said that that's deterioration of the nerve cells that also attacks the nerve cells in the retina. So what do you know about Stargardt? And are they using the stem cell research to find out about this disease also? And what is the progress they're making on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So retinitis pigmentosa itself is a very, it's kind of a grab bag in terms of that there's over 120 different genes causing retinitis pigmentosa. So when we say retinitis pigmentosa, we're talking actually about 120 different diseases all lumped together in this one diagnosis. And Stargardt's is a protein that's malformed called ABCR, and this protein affects the layer just underneath the retina called the retinal pigment epithelium. I think, and it, as you said, affects central vision often first, although some people with the same exact protein problem will lose their peripheral vision first. And that's the same in retinitis pigmentosa. Some people may have the same gene that we think is the cause. One person will lose their peripheral vision first. Another person will lose their central vision. So why would that be? Most likely because there's another protein that's playing a role. So each person probably has a second protein that's acting as a intermediate that causes one set of cells to react versus the other. Stargardt's, I think, will directly benefit from both gene therapy as well as from these supportive therapies like the study I talked about with CNTF. In other words, a growth factor that keeps the cells alive. So I think both the cell therapy in terms of transplantation of this layer of cells that have been damaged, the RPE cells, as well as these growth therapies will make a big difference for Stargardt's. So there's a lot of research in that area. No clinical trial right now, though.
Thank you very much. I think that's an exciting report. Okay. There's been a change in our program. You may or may not heard. On Saturday afternoon, the third general session, we have in the program Tony Sauer, director of the Department of Rehabilitation, on there as giving an update on the Department of Rehab with. And because of some scheduling problems, he contacted CCB and asked if he could speak this evening. So we have asked, and President Pomerantz graciously agreed to give his space for the presentation from Tony Sauer. And Mitch will give his presentation tomorrow afternoon. So I would like at this time to turn the mic over to Tony Sauer to give an update on the Department of Rehab.
Thank you, Gene. And also, Mitch, thank you for accommodating my schedule. You basically saved my social and my personal life. being away from home way too many weekends. I really do appreciate that. And Tony Candela is to my left, and Tony actually will be doing most of the talking tonight. And Tony will be with you all day tomorrow as well, I believe, most of the day, as well as some other staff. And it's good to see you again, Gene. I don't know if you remember, but we used to sit on a access committee for many, many years, back probably 10 or 15 years ago. Yeah. Before I start, the gentleman, Roger, I think it's Peterson, who spoke, asked a question of the previous speaker. And I don't know if it was a question as much as making a statement of the tension between curing various disabilities, including blindness or what have you, versus the tension of disability pride and being okay with the disability and living with it and actually making the best of what your circumstance is. And that's a fascinating bit of tension because that's what most disability groups go through, including my disability group, which is spinal cord injury. The fascinating also thing is that stem cell research is something that has been talked about for about 30 years with spinal cord injury, and we're still waiting for that magical cure. But it's I think it is important to look at the future and look at what things can be cured, and not necessarily that will prevent blindness, but maybe the secondary things that go along with blindness and the other factors that happen in life. And for me, being a paraplegic, you know, it's walking's not all it's cracked up to be, but all the other things that go along with being a paraplegic, the bladder infections and the bowel issues and the circulation issues are troubling. But those of us who have lived with our disability many years, we've come to a place of being, I guess, more or less proud of who we are and our disabilities, and also kind of proud that it's made us better people in many cases. And I know for myself that that is the case. So that tension is always going to be there. I don't care what group it is, whether it's the blind groups or the deaf groups or wheelchair users. And it's okay to have that discussion, and it's healthy to have that discussion. At the same time, we do need to look forward. So anyway, it was fascinating that that discussion came up. It comes up in almost every forum where you're looking at cure versus being proud of who you are and proud of your disability. As probably anybody in the room know, everybody in the room knows that the California is going through a major budget crisis, and the Department of Rehabilitation is not exempt from that crisis. The governor asked us to look at 10% general fund cuts, which are very problematic when you look at our fairly rich 4-to-1 match. And when we first heard about this cut back in December, many of us lost sleep for a number of days, and we were worried that the $5.9 million in general fund cuts were going to equate to about a $27 million cut in our overall budget. And that also equated to a loss of well over 100 staff in our department. Many of those would have been counselors, and that definitely contradicts my goal of having more counselors and more face time with counselors and consumers. So staff sharpened pencils and worked late into the night, many nights in December, and we were able to be very creative and fend off most of our federal cuts that would have resulted in that $5.9 million general fund cut. So we were able to etch it down to just over $10 million in overall cuts. And two areas I think might impact folks in this room. One is potentially having to close 10 to 15 offices around the state of our 85 offices. We have a work group that's looking at that. And that's not something that we're looking forward to, but that may be one of the only ways to kind of make this work and to keep our services going and not have to close the doors for people who want our services. The other potential cut that may affect many people here is the 10% rate rollback for our providers, those doing our contracts and our fee for services. Both those are on the table. They're in the governor's budget, and we're moving forward with those. Now, how things play out over the summer, we don't know. But you may have questions, and we'll take those at the end. But just letting you know, those are the two main areas, and Tony may add to that. That's the two areas I think may interest this group more than any others. Back when I visited most of you in Southern California last fall, I heard and I saw in your minutes that you were concerned about our business enterprise program and our orientation center for the blind, some of the things that were going on with the center. Since that time, Tony Candela and I, mostly Tony's work, frankly, have pulled two work groups together, one for the BEP task force and one for the OCB task force, looking at the future of those two programs and how we can improve those programs and not just improve the things that maybe are problematic and are on your radar, but to really look into the future and move the programs kind of beyond average and something that's much better. I think there's so much potential for those programs. That being said, I'm going to let Tony, who's the detail person on all of our blind programs, get into more detail, and I will stay here and take your questions with Tony at the end.
Thank you, Mr. DeMille. That would be the fellow who's helping me with the microphone here. And I don't need to touch it. You're asking a blind guy not to touch something. That's very hard. Okay, we won't touch it. Okay, I would like to, first of all, say thank you to Mr. Jeff Tom for not only being a very close professional friend, always for telling me the truth about what you, his constituency, are saying to him. and also for his flexibility in twisting Mitch Pomerantz's arm and allowing us to be here tonight. And Mitch Pomerantz, we really are appreciative of you. You know, we're very lucky in California to have the president of ACB, one of our own, Mitch Pomerantz. I think it's really cool. Another person I'd like to say thank you to, he was last sighted at the bar about 15 minutes ago. He's still there, I'm told. That would be our good buddy, Mr. Dan Kaiser. And I really, really want to touch this microphone. This is really hard not to touch this. The thing that I am particularly thankful for was Dan and the California Council of the Blind shepherding through a piece of legislation to help us finally to get a workable law to provide our BEP vendors with a loan program, an interest buy-down type of loan program, which is something that's been in the works for 8 years. And the law that was passed to originally get that program set up just wasn't strong enough. And CCB shepherded through a bill, and now we have a workable law, and we're going to have a very workable loan program real soon. So, Dan Kaiser, I know you're out there somewhere. Thank you for your help on that. Okay, my job with the Department of Rehabilitation is to head up the Specialized Services Division, which came into existence in statute on July 1st of 2003. My immediate predecessor was a lady named Linda Bardis. And Linda is out and about somewhere, too. I don't think she's here, but she's, I think, has a house in Northern California now and a house in Tennessee, and she's doing well. The division was set up prior to this law being passed by the Department of Rehabilitation. The law was passed to etch it in stone. And so it's etched in statute. It exists primarily due to the efforts of the blindness communities, consumers, the service delivery system, and other advocates, both CCB and NFB, American Council, American Foundation for the Blind, and also many of the private agencies for the blind, all working together in a historical endeavor. And the prime mover and the person who turned the tide in the end that got the law passed was your own Kathy Skivers. And the fact that she knew somebody in a very high place in politics who in the end is what it takes often to get this kind of a law passed. And it's a tribute to Kathy and the kinds of friends that she has made over the years and the persistence that she has put into her work that not only did we have a friend in politics, but we've just have a friend in Kathy who is the president of my blind advisory committee and just contributes to us all the time. So we really appreciate Kathy Skivers. This is starting to feel like the State of the Union address where, you know, every 2 minutes somebody applauds. Then we're going to count up the number of seconds of the applause, and it'll be more than me having spoken, which is probably good. Okay, within the Specialized Services Division, for those of you who don't know, inside the Department of Rehabilitation, we have four units that work within that division. The biggest one is our Blind Field Services Unit, and I understand the program manager for the Blind Field Services Unit, Kathy Bales, is in the audience here. There she is. I hear her. Kathy supervises 80 staff members, and it seems like, you know, at least once or twice a day, she and I are talking about something, so it's a close working relationship. I love working with her. And her 80 staff members they include the 66 rehabilitation counselors of the blind who are working in the field offices. I believe 64 of the 66 slots are filled right now. is always off by one or two as somebody gets a promotion or somebody leaves and we're recruiting somebody else. There are some program specialists and others who also work in the unit. But those counselors are the ones in the field offices. They're in the branch offices. They're in the district offices all around the state. And they are the ones who work directly with our vocational rehabilitation consumers, helping them to formulate plans for employment and shepherding their services, doing all of the paperwork necessary to get things done. And those counselors are going to have some help real soon. We in the Department of Rehabilitation have piloted in two positions within the department a specialty called Procurement Specialist. And we are about to launch forward and hire 5 more of them. And by the time we're done, we'll have 13, one in each of the districts around the state. And these are the people who are going to make the purchase of assistive technology fly through like lightning. The community has been asking us in various ways over the years, is there anything you guys can do to speed up the process of getting assistive technology for your consumers? And many of the problems have been system connected. This specialty position is designed to cut through a lot of the complexities that the system puts out there. A lot of purchasing laws, things that we actually don't have any control over but have to obey, are part of the kind of work that it takes to make a purchase of something that might cost $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. And so, you know, your government watches out for every penny that it spends. Sometimes it doesn't seem that way, but we do. And this specialty position is going to, I think, speed things up. You will notice a difference. We project this by the end of this fiscal year to have placed 400 individuals into employment, into gainful remunerative employment. That will be slightly less than what we've done the last couple of years. We believe that the economy is taking its toll on all of our consumers within the Department of Rehabilitation, but still pretty good considering the staffing level has remained the same. We've had a bit of turnover. We got a bunch of new counselors in, a few new supervisors. I think our staff is fresher. They're better trained than ever. They have to meet a certain level of qualifications educationally before they can be hired. A higher level of qualification than in the past. So as time goes on, I think you're going to see, especially as our new counselors get more and more trained in the rehabilitative techniques of blindness and visual impairment, you're going to see a lot of good things coming from this. We have about 5,500 active cases in blind field services at any one time. And about 3,000 to 3,500 of them end up in homemaker plans and the rest in remunerative employment plans. We've been shifting that number as time has gone on to a balance where at the end of a year, something like 60% of our closures are going to be homemakers, and about 40% will be remuneratively employed individuals. The folks who are above age 55, if they are not interested in employment, often go into our older blind program where they're served by agencies for the blind and one or two independent living centers out in the community. We have 17 Title VII Chapter 2 contracts out there for services to the older blind. We put out an in-house newsletter that we put it out electronically. It's called The Visionary. And The Visionary is really of and by and for our counseling staff. I'm the editor-in-chief. It's a labor of love for me. And we send it out to the counselors and to some of our primary stakeholders by email. And then it gets around. And we write it, and I edit it with the fact that I know it's going to get outside of the organization in mind. So anything that's in there is, it's fine if... Somebody emails it to one of you, that's perfectly fine. Doesn't hold a candle to your own newsletters and magazines, which I do read religiously, but it's something that we do to help counselors helping themselves to know about success stories and things like that. Our orientation center for the blind in Albany, California, its optimal consumer carrying capacity is around 30 individuals. It's got 36 beds, but staffing levels make 30 the optimum. We reversed a downturn, and we reversed a trend in the referral rate, and over the last year, our referrals have gone back up. We've done some curriculum changing, revamping of how we schedule students, what kinds of group training we do, what kinds of individual training we do. We're working on an ongoing fashion to modernize the teaching that goes on at OCB. And as of a couple of weeks ago, last time I got a report from the administrator, Mike Cole, who will be here tomorrow, we were up to 25 individuals with referrals in the hopper. So we feel we reversed the trend, and people are feeling comfortable that they're getting a quality service at OCB. But believe me, the work has only just begun. We have a long-term strategic planning process underway that Tony Sauer mentioned, including some work groups that is going to decide what will OCB look like 5 and 10 years from now. There are 31 staff members at OCB. 10 of them are instructors. Then we have groundskeepers and janitors and the cooks and, you know, folks like that. We hope to have serviced around 60 consumers altogether. They come in and they go out as they graduate. So by the end of the year, we hope to have serviced about 60 consumers. A study was just done by a lady, I think her first name is Susan, her last name is Ali, out of Long Beach State. She did a study of how OCB provides its services, and that report is in our hands. I haven't read it yet, but the abstract, the executive summary in front, shows that in her analysis of how OCB does its work, consumer satisfaction, follow-up data where some of the consumers ended up, things of that nature that are important factors that the organization is doing well. And she is preparing an article for the Journal of Visual Impairment and Blindness that hopefully in the next year or so, when it's written and it gets all through the editing and publishing process, that there'll be an article in the prestigious Journal of Visual Impairment and Blindness on the OCB. So we're looking forward to that. Business Enterprises Program. I probably spend about 60% of my time on the Business Enterprises Program. We also have a future oriented long-term strategic planning work group going here too. 31 staff members. 10 of them are Business Enterprises consultants. Those are the kind of the functional equivalent of a counselor, but within the BEP. They're the ones who work with the vendors who are operating facilities directly, giving them business coaching, things like that, helping them when it's time for us to buy some new equipment for them, and lots of other tasks. So there's 10 of them out of the 31 staff members. We have an architect, an assistant architect that helps design new facilities, works with state and federal office buildings and other places where we have facilities, things like that. There are 151 active vendors as of our report to the federal government for the 2007 fiscal year, 151 of them, servicing 158 locations, which means somebody is actually holding both their own location and maybe acting as an interim vendor in a location where we have to get a new vendor to go in there. So that's why there may be more facilities than vendors. But we have a class that's about to graduate. We expect 5 people to successfully complete the training class that's underway right now. And we're about to start recruiting for next year's class. I was looking at the income data. I think the average income for our vendors, I'm not going to say the number out loud, but I think the average income for our vendors is starting to move upward, and it's getting close to what the national average is. I'm going to need a better data analysis to actually know for sure how the feds will compare our vendors' average income level to that for the rest of the country. And until they actually do the comparison, I won't know for sure. But it looks like we've made a big jump closer to the national average. We've been kind of under it for a while, but I think we've made some strides. Part of the reason for that is a lot of the facilities out there that aren't making a lot of money are getting consolidated with others or getting closed. And other things that we're doing to improve the program to help the vendors to make more money. Some of you may know that we did a self-audit. We asked our own audit department to audit the program, and they came up with some findings. So we're right in the middle of what we call a corrective action plan right now to fix some of the bureaucratic things that that need to be patched up. This will also include training for our staff, and it'll include systems changes that maybe make it to make it a little more easy for everybody to do their work. We're recruiting shortly. We'll actually begin interviewing for a program manager. We have an acting program manager in there now, a fellow named Joe Xavier, who I think is going to be here tomorrow and sit in on the Randolph Shepherd Vendors of California meeting. I think that's happening tomorrow. And Joe is just in an acting program manager role. He has another job with us he'll go back to when we hire a permanent. But he's a good, strong manager, and that's the kind of person that we're going to be hiring to be the permanent manager. I also supervise the Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services, which is an administrative and technical advisement unit for the counselors who work with deaf consumers, our rehabilitation counselors of the deaf. That was also put into the Specialized Services Division. He's got 48 rehabilitation counselors for the deaf that he advises. That's my program manager for Deaf and Hard of Hearing Services, and it's been a pleasure to work on that side of the house as well as on the blindness side of the house. And where the two come together is in service to the deaf-blind, and that's where the two come together. My other hat that I wear is I'm the statutory representative to the Guide Dog Board of California. I was assigned that job by Tony Sauer. And so I'm on the Guide Dog Board, and we are making a good working relationship with the Guide Dog Users of California, and I'll be in their business meeting and speaking sessions tomorrow. I'll be there. Now I'm just going to skip ahead because I know I've got to stop. We're in the middle of strategic planning right now. Our new executive officer, Antoinette Sorek, is doing a wonderful job. She's actually here in the audience somewhere. If you give her an applause, please. You're welcome. We invite you. We announce the Open Meetings Act is in full force when our board, the Guide Dog Board, meets. We invite you to Guide Dog Board meetings. Anybody who is interested in what happens in the guide dog industry in California, the welfare of guide dog handlers in California, how we license trainers in the state of California, things like that. Come to our meetings. They're announced on the website, and I'm going to give you the address for the website. The Guide Dog Board is under the Department of Consumer Affairs, so the Guide Dog Board website is under the Department of Consumer Affairs major website, and it's www.dca, Department of Consumer Affairs, .ca.gov/guide dog board/ www.dca.ca.gov/guide dog board/ I want to leave you with a piece of advice from me. Understand how your government works. Ask Dan Kaiser, he'll tell you. Understand how your government works through and through. So you'll know how agencies like mine work, You'll know why our budget gets affected the way it does. You'll know why we do some things that you can't believe that we do. You'll know the laws that govern us, and maybe even the regulations. You'll understand about laws and regulations. Understand how your government works. Because in understanding how it works, you'll understand how to be more effective advocates for what you want and what you need. And if it means that you have to make my life miserable once in a while, that's fine. That's fine, because it means that something is happening that you don't like and you want it to be better. That's totally fine. But please understand how your government works, because that's how you'll be the best advocates that you can be. And so I leave you with that advice, and I thank you very much for your attention.
Would like to accept any questions.
Okay. This is proactive. This is a good one. Okay.
It's Tricia.
Hi, you guys. It's Tricia Leitz. And I wanted to actually go back to the beginning where we were talking about all people with disabilities and how we can help all of them best. And I also want to talk about the new procurement procedures at the department and how we have the new procurement specialists and we're getting more of them. And one thing I really want to try to maintain for consumers at the department, and I know you all be in favor of this, is making sure that they still have choice and still maintain that the consumers will have their services individualized. And how we could best do this would be through, I think, a memo. Because what I hear, and just walking around today and talking with various people, is that some of this is getting lost in terms of the procurement process. And there was a couple things that people stressed. One was that we could make sure that the counselors work with the consumer on knowing what the specifications are of the technology they need. So if they want a laptop, we need to talk about the warranty or the megabytes and gigabytes, or do you want a Dell or HP? What is that going to be before we go right on to the procurement specialist? Because right now we're hearing things like the procurement specialist is just getting an idea like, I need a laptop, and then they go out to the vendors. So, and then, of course, that will just make more problems for later on when the consumer really gets it. And then the second thing would be that if the counselor doesn't, if they're working with a consumer that knows their stuff, of course, they can work through the issues of, knowing what the specifications are, but also just to stress to the counselors to use assessments that are non-biased, of course, so that we get the best assessments possible for people. And then the other thing would be that the counselors also need to be stressing best value. So when the bids come in to the procurement specialist, sure, they'll get a bid for maybe $300 for a computer. But it may be the lowest cost, but it won't be the best value. They might have a very poor quality service, that company, or you might have to do a lot of troubleshooting later on with that company and that computer. So the counselors not only have to put together the specifications, but also stress the best value before anything goes on to the procurement specialist. And if that could be done through a memo, that would kind of help us keep teaching people over and over the importance of that. I don't know what you guys think of that, but...
Well, thank you, Tricia. I think, in the fine-tuning that we are always doing, when we start a new process using different people to do a lot of the legwork, let's say in this case on buying things, we will be working, because it's new and it's the time to be able to introduce our procedures now before we get all etched in stone. So thank you for the advice.
Okay. If there's something I could do on Monday, if I could recap it in any way and put it together, I would really like to try to move on something, just because I think it's really impacting people right now.
Send me a memo.
Excellent. And it needs to go out to all the services, not just Blindfield services. Mm-hmm. It really is impacting all people with disabilities at the department. So.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And Tricia, those of you who don't know Tricia, she is one of our great counselors at the department, and she and Dan Kaiser and some other folks actually have, we didn't mention this, but have got a group together through the First Lady's office that has morphed itself into a more of an advocacy group, getting several high-level officials, not just at the Department of Rehab, but State Personnel Board, EDD, to look at employment and hiring practices within state service for people with disabilities. So I want to thank you and Dan and the others. Tricia, thank you.
Okay. Yes. Thanks.
Kathy Skivers is the next
I have
person.
A brief comment and a question. We have something I think is pretty good in California. We have a rehabilitation director, and we have a social service director. You've heard from both of them today, and I'm on the advisory committee, chair of it, and I tell you something, we can talk to those people. We've always been able to talk to them, but you know what? They listen. And I'm very pleased with that. Tony Sauer has really tried to learn what we're all about, and it's a hard job, and appreciate where he's coming from. And my question, Tony, I think, is to you. The study that you mentioned from Southern California, I'm always curious when I hear people in these colleges that have gone off and done studies about various aspects of our lives. I wonder, are we going to be able to see those studies? I'm fascinated by some of those, and some are good, and then there are the others. And I wonder, Tony, are we going to be able to see this study that you referred to earlier?
Oh, I would imagine so. I have to read it myself so I can tell you what I actually think of the guts of the study. I know what the broad results are, and I'm sure that the author, because she's told me she's preparing an article for the journal, that she probably would be happy to put out some kind of like an executive summary or something like that, but she'll probably reserve the main you know, good stuff until she publishes. But I will be in touch with her next week after I read the article, because she's going to need permissions from us to approach the Journal of Visual Impairment to publish the article. So I know I'm going to be talking to her.
Is she a blind person?
Yeah. Yeah, out of Long Beach State. Yes, she is. But, you know, that don't
Thank
necessarily
you.
Mean, just like a sighted person may not necessarily always be biased in the wrong direction, a blind person may not always be biased in the right direction either. So we look at things for what they are, and we look at people for who they are, and we don't prejudge on the basis of anything.
Tony,
when
we're not
I look at that study, I'll let you know if I think it's good.
We're not prejudging. My thought is that, and most of us in this room, I don't know how many people know that lady in Long Beach, but she's a blind person, and most of us around here, we've never heard of her. And I always get nervous when people that don't know who we are, and we don't... Oh, good. She's one of ours. That must be all right.
Uh-oh. We're in trouble.
I knew I couldn't get through a meeting without causing trouble.
Okay. Lewis, you're the next person.
Okay. When you talk about a small world, boy, it is a small world. Suzanne Ali was one of my students at Cal State Long Beach. She is a member of the Greater Long Beach Chapter, member of CCB and ACB. And I'm pretty sure that she will be available for doing a workshop of some sort in the fall in L.A. So it's she's a beautiful young lady in terms of personality, in terms of perseverance. She's sort of a role model in terms of perseverance. The question that I would have to ask either Tony S. or Tony C., tell me, when you talk about understand how your government works, when we look at DR, when we look at really the Department of Rehabilitation as it stands now, is there a publication that helps us understand the organizational structure of DOR, how it has changed, and more or less get a picture of where the department is going? I'm sure either one of you could answer that question. But I think it's very important, it's very critical, and Dan Kaiser would echo that statement, that we need to know how our government works, and we need to understand how DOR works.
You know, Tony and I both looked together, and we don't know the answer to that question, which maybe what it does is offers up we don't want to do it now, we don't have the time, I'm sure Jeff will run us out of the room if we try to do a whole overview of what department looks like within Health and Human Service Agency. But I think Tony and I would be very open at your next meeting or next session, although you're maybe the next one in Sacramento, that we talk about the organizational structure, what it looks like, and how to get things done beyond us. And I would definitely hope Dan Kaiser would be part of that. But I don't think now's the time. But we, there's no publication that I could share with you, and sending you to the state's website, I think, would just cause more frustration.
Yeah.
So I'd be open to do a little workshop.
You know, I think that's possibly that could be a topic for the rehab group to consider putting on a workshop to educate, because I totally have to agree with Tony, really understand government and how the agencies work with and go through the administrative manual and understand how that manual is used in favor of clients and sometimes against clients. So, unfortunately, because of the time, David Jackson has the last opportunity, the last question. Okay, David, and then Wynn.
Okay. My name's David Jackson, and I'm the OCB alumni president. And I just want to ask you about your facilities capacity. You're getting the capacity back up to 30, and you said that you've got 25 more. I guess you've got 25 now, and referrals are on the way. My question is what's different from years past? What are you doing now? What is that change? How did you make that change? Are you getting your counselors? How are you getting your counselors to make more referrals?
Great question. What's caused the turnaround at OCB? First of all, we are not resting on our laurels, and the referral pattern to OCB has always been a roller coaster. Through all the years, it goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down. And I have noticed in the industry in general, the same thing happens to other agencies, other service agencies as well. It's not just just the OCB. When I first got to California in 2000, another residential training center, the one that Ken Metz works for, the Davidson Program for Independence, was almost out of business. They weren't getting referrals, and lots of meetings were held, and a combination of making some changes and a combination of just working with the counselors to remember to refer helped there. With the OCB, a combination of some curriculum revisions, some modernization of some of the things that we're teaching, but a promise for more modernization in the future, and also a lot of marketing. And what with some of the changing of the counselors who you know, either haven't developed their favorite agency to refer to yet, and we're open to making referrals to OCB. So some of the things that go on when we talk about the referral pattern to an organization, either OCB or any other one, has a lot to do with the fact that we're in a very small community, and very few counselors relative to the number of agencies around the state, that one or two counselors deciding they want to refer to this place and they don't want to refer to that place can markedly affect the organization. That's a thing that happens in we have a big state. We don't have a whole lot of agencies relative to the square mileage of the state of California, and we have a relatively small number of counselors for the potential voc rehab population that we could be serving. I don't think the 5,500 people that we have in our caseloads at any given time are enough. I think that there is a lot more people out there that we could be serving. They're just hard to find. So the answer to your question, marketing and curriculum modernization.
My question, I'm Winifred Downing. My question concerns two pieces of information that will help us on the resolutions committee with some resolutions that we're talking about. Do you have difficulty obtaining and retaining well-trained rehabilitation counselors? And how do the salaries for those individuals compare with the work done by similar people for the Veterans Administration doing similar work?
The answer to the question is really easy. The salaries of our rehab counselors in state service are far below. I don't actually remember the numbers offhand, but they're far below what the Veterans Affairs Department pays its rehab counselors. However, the gap between what our counselors make and what other counselors make in different venues, like community colleges, some county organizations, is not as big a gap. State rehab counselors across the board do not make as much money as they ought to. You can applaud the counselors because they deserve your applause. Please. Absolutely. What it's going to take for those salaries to go up is actually beyond the Department of Rehabilitation by itself. It's an issue of the state budget. It's an issue of the state's Department of Personnel Administration and the State Personnel Board, and a lot of factors. It's something that will be influenced, I'm sure, based on how much money there is available, to a greater extent or lesser extent, by the collective bargaining that will happen. The unions will get into this mix. So when we talk about salaries for people in various classifications within state service, we don't just think about it from the point of view of what can one department do, because this is bigger than just one department. But we know our counselors are not paid well enough. We want our counselors to be paid more. We have spoken up. We have said that out loud. We also know that the forces out there that will affect what will happen next are beyond just us. But we know they need more money.
How about obtaining and retaining well-trained counselors?
I think that we're not losing as many counselors as it sounds by that question, to be honest with you. I don't think we're having a big retention problem. We're having a small one. We're losing counselors in two ways, some to higher salaries, not too many, but some to higher salaries, yes, definitely. We're also losing them in the sense that typically, if you look at the graduating classes from the rehabilitation counseling master's degree programs, we lose counselors in that they never even bother to apply for state service to begin with. And typically, two-thirds of those who graduate from master's degree programs don't want to work for the state. Maybe about half of them that graduate actually never even bother to apply to the state. So we have a recruitment issue. The way we're dealing with the recruitment issue is by going out there and going to the schools, both those that have rehab counseling training programs and others where there may be people earning master's degrees in closely related fields that would also qualify to take the civil service exam. We're also working to make it easier for people to apply for and to get into state service. We have a new online civil service examination for rehab counselors, which has worked. Maybe triple the number of people on our civil service list now than we did, say, a year ago.
I actually think we've sextupled.
We've sextupled it, huh?
I believe so.
I was afraid
over
to
600.
Use that word. So that's in the recruitment side of the house. In the retention side of the house, if you can get past the two major bugaboos, maybe the three. The three major bugaboos are salary, caseload size, and those difficulties that make people have to work so much extra hard just to do some of the routine things, like when we were talking before about the procurement aspect of their jobs. So we're currently working on developing a new way of delivering services. We've got some other task forces going right now to see whether or not there could be a better way to provide services to our consumers that will make the job of the well-trained rehabilitation counselor, which is what you got to be now to get hired by us. You have to meet certain federal standards now, including having a master's degree. But to make their job be more the kind of a job that counselors always thought they would be doing when they came into state service or wherever they might go, and to maybe have some technicians and other people like that doing some of the gut work, the kind of thing that makes the life of a counselor miserable. So someday in the future we'll specialize our staff. We hope that in such a way that the counselor will get to be a counselor, and that means that instead of only 50% of those graduates applying for jobs, maybe now 75 or 80% will, and they'll be much happier when they're doing their jobs.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank both Tonys for the update on the Department of Rehab, despite the impact of the future budget. It looks like there's some things to feel very encouraged about, and I hope continue. So again, thank you very much for coming this evening.
Welcome.
Okay, our next speaker is Jeff Tom. Going to give the press... Why?
Don't ask me.
Well, I think we'll have the presidential report from the CCP president, Jeff Tom.
Okay. I'm going to hurry along because we have two outstanding speakers, or at least I'm going to, after maybe, or I'm going to hurry part of this along. Just one moment. Ken Stewart, if you're out there, and I assume you are, if you don't mind, I'm going to delay you until tomorrow when I have a little more time so that I don't give you short shrift at a late hour. I want to cover one thing quickly and two other things with a little more, a little less brevity. I want to open by talking about membership very quickly. We have a chance, you know, every year I think is a good year when membership increases. And our membership figures are always a little squirrely because, you know, early in the year they gradually go up and then they all of a sudden, you know, hit a little plateau around the spring convention when everybody has their rosters in. And then they gradually go up again. And then in the fall convention they obviously hit their basic plateau for the year. Last year we were down, which is nothing unusual, in the high 1100s, and we ended up in the around 1370 something. This year we were in the high 1100s at spring convention, I believe. This year we're already over 1200, not much over 1200, but we are. So if every chapter, and I'm sure that Artis will give you some of this information for those chapters who send representatives to the membership meeting. But if every chapter, and several of them have already exceeded their membership for last year, their complete membership, but if every chapter can either equal or exceed their membership, we will definitely increase to over 1,400 this year and be on our way to 1,500 again, which is where we really want to be. But let's, you know, go one little plateau at a time. And so I challenge every chapter, and I challenge my chapter, to equal its membership at least from last year. We're down below a little bit, and we got to do something to get those members back. So, and I challenge every chapter. I don't challenge my chapter too loudly because, you know, it wouldn't be good. Okay. The next thing I want to do is give a report on the resolutions from the fall. First one, B1. I won't read the B every time. They're all B's. Repealing the provision that delays the annual cost of living increase for SSP. We tried to get a bill like that. We fought hard. It's not really a year where that was feasible, if there is going to be any year in the near future. I think we did have some impact on getting the on furthering the debate. Ended up where the delay of this year's increase was only through. I can't remember. It's been a few months since I've dealt with it. The beginning of, I think it's November 1 or October 1, I think. It could have been completely completely chopped away for the whole of 2008, so it wasn't a total loss. Because then, come next year, we'll get another increase. But as it is, they keep delaying the cost of living increases, and that's money that doesn't go into the pockets of deserving SSI recipients. So it's something we have to keep fighting. Okay. two, which many of you know about, to have parents' rights materials at CSB, California School for the Blind. And many of you were hard at work on AB 2555 the other day at the Capitol. I want to just thank everybody who made it, the 30 people. That is a record, I think, for this organization as far as I've ever heard. Yeah, let's hear it for everybody. That was great. It's a bill that is very small in the scheme of things, and yet it can have some major results for those children who need either short-term or long-term education at CSB. Maximize their educational potential. And many parents just don't know, either don't know about CSP at all or don't really know what they have to offer. And sometimes, either for a long-term or short-term, they can really be a more appropriate educational setting. So we'll see. We've made it through a committee. We're hoping that the ravages of bills that are supposed to cost any money whatsoever don't kill this one. And we'll see. We think it's got at least a chance, and we're going to fight for it. Okay. Number three looked this dealt with strategic planning process at OCB, and as you know, Director Sauer, actually even before the resolution was passed, pledged to have that task force, and it has, of course, with Tony Candela, already met its first time. So that is moving along. Number four is getting the California's voter guide into different types of accessible formats. And Dan has worked with the Secretary of State, and that is moving along, and I think they're going to have some prototypes. Dan may mention that a little bit more tomorrow in his report, but we have had some work in that area. Okay, number five. We urge the department to make intake forms accessible. And in a letter from Director Sauer, they are working on that. It's not necessarily an easy task, but it's something that I think everyone agrees must be done. And the director was absolutely adamant that they had to get that done. I don't think it's been achieved yet, but I know that our rehab committee is very vigilant about making sure that we keep their hands to the fire on that issue, and I think the director was very responsive to that resolution. Okay, number six. I'm off mic. Okay. The department must we sought to have the department provide accessible technology for its employees and have a best practices manual, and I'm going to try to sometimes it's better to read a statement rather than try to characterize it. And so I'm going to do that in this case. So I will read what the director wrote to us on that one. DOR is committed to make its information technology systems accessible to people with disabilities, including those who are blind. The DOR advocates for accessible software throughout the state. When older software or new software that is needed but not accessible must be used, the Information Systems Service Unit works with an in-place disability access committee to alleviate problems. In addition, a volunteer group of screen reader users of varying ability levels tests all electronic forms created by created or modified. We will consider the use of a manual, as you suggest, and continually strive to achieve accessible technology. Well, I have to say that's a fair answer, but it's not as much of an answer as I'd like to see. So I think we're going to have to do a little more advocating to see that something definitely does get done. I think I do still hear complaints from the field on inaccessibility of technology. It is a real problem. I know it. I face it myself. But nonetheless, it's absolutely essential if our blind counselors are to do the best possible job for the clients, and that's our number one concern. Okay, let's see. Number seven is to develop a system of accessible consumer surveys for use by independent to develop a system of accessible consumer surveys and use an independent entity to achieve them. The department has agreed to work on that, and I don't think as of this point any progress in that area has been made, so we'll have to monitor that. But that's something that will take some time to do as well. But nonetheless, we'll monitor that. We'll certainly make sure on both these last two resolutions that the Blind Advisory Committee is kept in the loop. And as long as we have folks like Kathy and Rhonda and Charles Navarrete on board, we'll make some noise whenever we need to make it. Okay. Number nine. Number eight was withdrawn or something happened to it, but it didn't pass. So I don't have to report on it. Number nine was to take steps to have the State Personnel Board make its website fully usable. And, of course, as the director mentioned a few minutes ago, the task force has been working on that, among other things. And I think that Dan may want to mention this tomorrow as well, but there has been a great deal of work on that website, apparently, and the strides have been made in that area. So they are taking that very seriously. Okay, number 10 is a request to provide equivalent information in Braille to that provided in print with respect to the instructions for the digital players that are produced by RFB&D, Recordings for the Blind and Dyslexic. I'm going to have to check on that again. I have communicated with RFB&D, but I haven't gotten back to them yet. I will do that, and hopefully I will have an answer before the ACB convention, because if I don't, then we'll have to bring that to the ACB convention as well. So, okay, we now go to 13, which called on Caltrans to take various actions, including developing an ADA transition plan that we've been asking for quite some time. And these actions are essentially consistent with the litigation in which CCB and Californians for Disability Rights are both involved. We have had some action in that area, and I should mention that the resolution also addressed the issue of the fact that Caltrans was specifically trying to undercut the constitutionality of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We have had some action on that front, which hasn't necessarily borne fruit yet, but we're hoping it did. It will. The nominee for the agency that oversees Caltrans was really unwilling to, in discussions, we gave him, he was being nominated by the governor, and his appointment was up by the Senate Rules Committee. And so we wanted to give him a chance before we opposed his nomination to agree to do something about this case. And he said, no, I don't want to do anything. So we decided that we had no other choice but to go into the Senate Rules Committee and say we can't support a man who wants to basically do nothing about an agency that has been out of compliance with the ADA for essentially decades. And so the Senate Rules Committee was shocked at this particular response, and they basically said in no uncertain terms, we're going to nominate you, but we expect some results. So we have so far not had those results necessarily, although things are sort of in a holding pattern, as litigation often is when it drags on forever. So we're still communicating with the legislature on this, and we wouldn't be surprised. Or we wouldn't be surprised either way. We wouldn't be surprised if nothing happened because of it, but we also wouldn't be surprised if something did happen and the tensions sort of ratchet down. So stay tuned on that one. We'll see. Okay. 14 was to urge the president of ACB to write to the United States Attorney General relative to obtaining an interpretation of the definition of tasks of service signal and guide animals under the ADA, and I believe that this was done. He can probably report on that tomorrow in his report, but it's my understanding that that did happen, or something like that happened. That finishes that report, so I want to go on to my final thing, and I want to call up to the podium Jacqueline Jackson. Most of you are aware of a little bit already of what I want to talk about, but the board has agreed and to begin what I think will be the opening of an incredible new potential chapter for the California Council of the Blind. which I hope will open a new way of financial and other support that will enable this organization to go to a higher level, not necessarily in the short term, but definitely in the long term. The Board of Directors has authorized us to establish Friends of California Council of the Blind. Before I let Jacqueline Jackson talk to you about our little opening gambit on this, I'm going to read to you a brochure, and then at the end, so as not to waste time, at the end we're going to do one of two things. We have copies for everybody in the back. I think what we'll do is we'll post in the back, when you leave, we'll post in the back of the room Ed and Mary Lou. It'll have maybe the large print, Mary Lou with the Braille. If you want a copy, then you can do it. Otherwise, we'll leave copies at registration. You can pick them up there. We'd like everybody to have a copy. Let me read this to you. Let me because I don't want... We're going to do it at the end. Well, but they can pass by. One of you can have print, one of you can have Braille. And as you pass by in the back... Okay. I've been instructed to do it. We're going to do it very quietly, but we'll do it this way. All Braille readers or the one Braille, raise their hands, and we'll give you a Braille copy right now. But do it quietly, please. I'm going to read it to you now, and then Jacqueline's going to make some comments, and that's going to be the end of my report for this evening, but I will leave some time to open it for questions about this or anything else. But I just want to say, well, I'll just go ahead and read. Won't do any more. Purpose. This is called Introducing Friends of the California Council of the Blind. Purpose. To assist the California Council of the Blind with the accomplishment of its vision, mission, and goals through volunteer service, advocacy, and fundraising. To support the CCB in building a solid foundation that ensures our legacy of improved quality of life for blind and vision-impaired individuals. We need corporations, organizations, and people like you who have a family member, friend, or colleague experiencing vision loss, are passionate about making a difference in the lives of people with vision loss, are quiet philanthropists developing or expanding your charitable giving base. It is our hope to formally launch this existing new program at our fall 2008 convention with at least 100 friends of the California Council of the Blind and kick off our Diamond Anniversary fundraising campaign. We can only accomplish this goal with your support. And then there's a place for essentially checking whether you want to become a friend or not. I won't bother to read that part. Let me just finish by saying we have under the board motion, we have a temporary committee, which we're going to change slightly, of two board members, and which are Donna Pomerantz and Rhonda King, and three non-board individuals. Jacqueline, who's the chairwoman, Artis Bazin and Frank Welty. It's going to morph into a committee of four people, two board and non-board, and three outside people when we get them picked and selected and they're on board. But for now, I think that's about as much as I want to say at the moment, but I'd like to let Jacqueline, the chair, say a word to you all about her hopes and goals for this venture.
All right.
Okay. Large print readers, raise your hands.
Okay. Good evening, my fellow CCB members. It's an exciting time for me and for us. We're 74 years old. And next year, we're going to enter into our Diamond Anniversary year. And we have done this fabulous work so that we can make sure that lives for persons with vision impairments and blindness have improved quality of life. And we've done it alone, per se, and it's time for us to have some friends. And we need your help to get those friends. I am a professional fundraiser by profession, and the Chronicle of Philanthropy says the reason why most people do not give is because they have not been asked. Okay? And I am a firm believer that a lot of people with a little bit of resources could do an outstanding, phenomenal job. For one of the organizations in San Diego, we started a campaign And we were trying to really raise more than $18,000. That's the most they ever did. In 5 months, with people giving a dollar a month for 5 months, and that was the people that were on Social Security, SSI, we were able to raise $72,000 in 5 months. And all we need is a few champions, which we know that we will get. And we need your support to pass out the information. Share, give someone the opportunity to be a friend. It could be your family member. It could be your doctor. There are organizations like the Delta Gammas, the Lions Clubs, that are looking for opportunities. And we have a fabulous organization that they could support. And we need your help to do this. So I'm encouraging all of you to please to take at least 10 per council group, per chapter, and to try to get those back in. And those of you could be individuals. We have our first friend of the CCB. I was excited. I talked to my daughter that lives in New Orleans. She's a graduate school student. But she said, Mom, I could do this and I will do this. So please, let's get this organization going. The Friends of the CCB, we won't have to worry about what hotel we're going to and if the price is going to be cost effective or not for us. We just need a few friends, and we need you to do it. I don't want to take up a lot of time. I know it's late, but I'm excited. I'm passionate about it, and I know that you are, and I'm going to be your cheerleader for this campaign. We have a fantastic committee, and together we could make a difference, and we will make a difference. Can I count on you? All right? Thank you.
Okay, tape readers, raise your hand.
The Friends will do other things besides raise money. They're going to be our volunteers. They're going to be our advocates. And we're going to have information on a website that we could tell them all about that information. You'll get plenty of information. But I'm trying to get 100 of those forms back to the CCB office before our fall convention. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jacqueline. With enthusiasm like that, we cannot fail. I think I misspoke and used the word chapter at one point. Obviously, I meant committee. I didn't even know that I said it, but fortunately, Gene was correct to set me straight.
You can put that right in front of you.
That basically concludes. Oh, and as Jacqueline said at the end there, all of this will be up on the website. We wanted to present it here at the convention first, but it will soon be up on the website. We can email it out, so you know we'll take advantage of all the potential formats.
Sure.
So I'm now open to questions briefly because we need to move the agenda along. But since we did cut this a little short, I think I have, you know, at the most a couple minutes for questions.
And these are questions to Jeff's in response to Jeff's report. Yes.
If you have questions, comments, yes. Rhonda. And Rhonda, I should say, was one of the, with Ann and I and Dan, was one of the originators of sort of looking into some fundraisers that eventually morphed into this. So Rhonda's really to be appreciated in this whole endeavor.
Okay, this comment is actually going to go to Jacqueline. And there is a gentleman who lives in Irvine, and his name is Frank Friend. And he went to Guide Dogs for the Blind a few years ago and got his first dog. And he was so impressed with that organization and what it does that he went out on his own and started doing fundraising and holding golf tournaments and stuff to raise money for Guide Dogs for the Blind. And he asked them if they could assist him in his efforts. And they said no. So they didn't help him at all. But he went ahead and did these golf tournaments, and he's done 3 or 4 of them now. And the first year he raised $8,000. The second year he raised, I believe, $18,000. And now he's raising $25,000 and $40,000. And he wants to find an organization, and I have spoke to him twice, and we've emailed. And I have talked to him, and I sent him the information about Friends of the California Council of the Blind.
And I want to send you the information I have, Jacqueline, and I believe that as excited as you are about this new group, that he might come on board, because I think this man could be a great asset to Friends of the California Council of the Blind.
Thank you, Rhonda. That's the excitement. Tell him, look no further. He has the organization. And I will call him tomorrow morning.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much.
No more questions for Jeff. Okay. Roy wants to make an announcement.
I do. Oh, yes. I'm Roy Harmon from the Randolph Shepherd Vendors of California. I think this is a great organization, the Friends of CCB. And I know that every dollar counts. And Randolph Shepherd Vendors of California will be donating $500 to this. And this is just the start, and we are going to promote this.
Hooray.
Unfortunately, I missed the October meeting because of the fires in the San Diego area. And I wanted to personally get up here and have the opportunity to thank Dan Kaiser for some work that he did for me. It was just unbelievable. And I think that any kind of advocacy that you can provide, either the blind vendors or just the blind organizations that you work with, is just great. And like I said, I'm going to try to promote this idea throughout the state, and maybe we can get some support from out of state as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Roy. Outstanding. Gene, I think that will do it. Thank you very much.
Next, we have a presentation from our domestic violence committee, and I think what I would like to turn it over to the vice chair of the committee, to Dr. Jones.
Oh, darling, I'm so tired this evening. I'm so glad to get home to you, sweetheart. You know, I can't help but say that I know that we will have a winner now that we have both of us voting for Obama in our home, sweetheart. We will have a new president. Oh, darling.
Wait a minute. I haven't made up my mind. Actually, I'm favoring Hillary.
What do you mean you're favoring Hillary?
Well,
now, wait a minute. What are you talking about?
I don't think Obama is like a junior senator. I really don't think he's qualified.
Are you going to split this house up after being together for over 20 years? You're going to split this house up? What are you talking about?
Well, if it's split up, it'll be because of you.
There will not be any split in this house over what's going to happen here. You're going to vote the way I want you to vote. You understand that?
No, I'm not.
You had better vote, because after all, darling, I'm filling out your absentee voting.
Oh, no. Now, listen for me for just a minute here. And look at Hillary.
I voted for who I wanted to vote for last year before. Although you wanted someone else, I voted for who I wanted to vote for.
Well, let me tell you, I want Hillary. I think she's got Bill behind her. He may have had his indiscretions, but Bill is how.
Did you hear what I said? We will vote for understanding?
No, I will not do that.
Now listen. Don't have me to put you out of here. It's because I'm tired of your arrogance and your shenanigans. I'm tired of it.
You mean after?
I haven't had any problems with you in all of these years. And just because there is someone voting of your culture, you don't want to respect mine.
Now, this has absolutely nothing to do with color.
Well, your vote has been cast for Obama.
Oh, no, 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 no. I'm not voting for Obama. I'm voting for Hillary.
Case closed. No. You know, what we wanted to show as brief as possible, how we are vulnerable. How we are vulnerable. How we put trust in some people and they have deflected our trust and our responsibilities of sharing our trust with them, right?
I believe so, but I do want to say that I'm on the Governmental Affairs Committee, you know, and I really do study the issues. And so I'm not just, you know, I'm just not an airhead voting for someone. I'm voting for the person I feel best qualified, and I do believe that to be Hillary.
And what we are saying is that it is very important in our relationships that we watch who's filling out our ballots, make sure and certain our ballots are marked the way we wish for them to be marked, and do not hesitate to call them on it when it is wrong, because there are many family disputes about that when it comes down to filling out our absentee ballot, correct?
Yes, but I wonder how else you would do this. Could you choose a trusted friend instead of your husband?
And it is always good to have a third party in mind. I'd like for you to check this for me, because sometimes we make mistakes. Yes. Oh, yes, 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 yes. I appreciate that. Thank you. It's because mistakes have been made. Families have been disrupted and almost on destruction over a vote.
And how many people do you think did not vote for George Bush and whose person who helped him with the ballot but got him on there? Do you think that could happen?
When I could not, and I am trusting the person who's filling out my ballot, anything can occur. And oftentimes, we don't have an opportunity to go second chance to see if it is filled out the way we wish for it to have been filled out. So in these voting times, and even in decision times, even in bill times, many times in some of our relationships, we need a second and a third party. Somebody that's in a lodge, somebody that's a close friend of ours, a sewing buddy, whatever. Somebody who can see, that we can confide in. I just would like for you to read this to me.
But I think the most important thing is, just because you're a blind or sight impaired individual, do not pass up your power to vote. Do not pass it up. You'll find somebody who can assist you. And it's very important that we take that stand and that we be heard when we vote. And that's very important. And it's very important we all get out there. Some people say, well, there's not much of a choice. It doesn't matter what I think. But it truly matters what you think. And you just can't give your power away. You've got to get out there and you've got to participate in the choices.
And we are not only talking about blind, but we're also talking about seniors and wheelchair-bound individuals. This is truly what happens to all of us.
Okay. I can't think of much else to say except get out there and vote. And, you know, and you can find, you could even go to a senior center if you need to, if you don't have anybody at home. You could find somebody who would assist you in voting, but as I said before, don't give up your power to vote.
Now, for the short time that we gave our skit, what did you think about it? Did it make sense?
And I trust that none of you would vote for somebody because of the color of their skin. Right. You know, that's the advantage we have over others. Many of us can't even see the color of someone's skin. So what they say and what they do is the most important thing to us. And so it's unfortunate that other people don't feel that way, but we want the best person. We're going to vote for the best person in our own view that we feel is qualified and not let any other barriers stand in our way.
If a relationship is going to be shaken because of a vote, that truly means that there wasn't really much in that relationship anyhow. So what we are saying, sometimes when people predicate a relationship because of a vote or because of what you're wearing or because of the color of your skin, they are just trying to find a way out. Just trying to find a way to end it so they can make you feel that you are the individual that broke up the relationship.
Well, that'll never happen to us, will it, Martin?
No, it won't happen to us. It's because, as the tune says, we're always forever.
Yes.
I wish to thank the Domestic Violence Committee for a very valuable lesson, and I hope that we all will take it to heart what they had to say. And thank you very much. As you probably, you may or may not be aware of, that the Public Utility Code, Section 2881, established a telecommunications access for the Deaf and Disabled Administrative Committee under the Public Utility Commission. Committee is to provide advice to the Commission on several matters, which include telecommunications equipment, telecommunications relay services, all used by persons with disabilities. We on occasions have the opportunity to spotlight some of our members who are doing significant contributions to their local as well as their state communities. And one of them is our next speaker, Annette Carter, who is a member of this administrative committee, and she represents the disability community on this committee. And we've asked her this evening to come and tell us more about the committee, what its role is, and the direction it's taking, and if we can be of any assistance to her and to the committee. So please give a warm hand to Annette Carter.
Thank you. I have one.
You got one.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to be talking to you about three parts. Landlines, wireless, and access to the program, because those are the hot questions that I'm getting right now. I want to kind of set a little more foundation, and I have four pieces of good news, which I'm really happy because there's not always something good to report, but I'll have four things of good news to report, and then some opportunities for you to have your voices heard. And I'm finding it really important to have your voices heard, because I'm seeing missing in the reports that I review every month, missing some of the things that I know you're saying. But because of reasons that I'll get into, it's not getting into the reports. I'm seeing other things that are getting in there, but they're not really being dealt with. So, first of all, like Jeff said, the TADAC, Telecommunications Access for the Deaf and Disabled Administrative Committee, is the advisory board that advises on policies, procedures, things like that to the Public Utilities Commission. And we have two subcommittees, one that works on the half of the program that you're most familiar with, and that's CTAP, California Telephone Access Program. You're familiar with the telephones, the landline telephones that have larger buttons. Some now have talking features, yay, different volume controls and things like that. And then the TTYs, those were the first legislation, enabling legislation, brought in the TTYs, and then it went on from the TTYs, then the California Relay Service, and then the other equipment. So that one half of the program is the California Relay Service. And there's still people that don't know what that is, so I'll describe that. If I'm deaf and I can't hear and I want to communicate with Jeff, I would pick up my TTY and I would type into it, and it would go through a CA that's a call assistant, and that call assistant would connect with Jeff's telephone and say, this is CA operator 2302 from California Relay Service. I have a call from Annette Carter. And he'd say, okay. And it may be a male voice speaking for me. And so it can be very awkward at times. He would respond back by voice, and that call assistant would type to me, and I would see it in my little visual display. So the service that provides that is California Relay Service. Now, I want to make it clear that the service that you have on your telephone isn't covered under this program. It's not in legislation where you have landline service covered. There is the lifeline thing, but that's something different. And I should pay attention to my notes. So CRS and CTAP, the California Relay Service, and the equipment side. So there's two subcommittees that advise on those. What kind of equipment to bring in the program? That's where, of course, your voices are really important. What do you want in a telecommunications device? What is not working well in a piece of equipment? Every time you make a comment that's supposed to be recorded by whoever you're talking to, whether it's the person in the service center, whether it's the person at the call center, the 800 number that you call, or a field advisor comes out to your home, or an outreach specialist, they record all of that, and I see it in the reports. Anyway, they make their reports. It comes up to us, and then we make a decision on that and then present it to the Public Utilities Commission, who sits at our committees. And we find that sometimes they say yes to something, and then they add a little bit something different that we didn't put in it. And we're an advisory board, so sometimes that happens. We're based on functional equivalence, not on a disability per se, and definitely not on financial need. Sometimes that's misunderstood. If you need a specialized phone, it would be your functional equivalence. A lot of people don't identify themselves with blindness, deafness, disabled, whatever. Nobody has to identify themselves with anything. It's what is my function that's limiting me to use that telephone or that telecommunication device. So those areas would be the classifications for the user groups would be deaf or late deafened, hard of hearing, cognitive, mobility or manipulation disability, blind, low vision, and speech disabled. So those are the main categories according to the legislation. How do you apply? There's a very simplified application with just your basic information with your landline telephone. To qualify, you have to it's your account is attached to your landline telephone service, but you don't have to be the payer of that bill. It doesn't have to be in your name. In other words, it could be a child in your home that needs the equipment. It could be a set of equipment. I have a vision loss and a hearing loss, and I need to be alerted that the telephone's ringing because I won't always hear it. So they may couple that amplified telephone with a pager that I would wear that would alert me to when that phone is ringing. So the equipment that can go with a phone is also included, but it couldn't be two pieces of a telecommunications device. There are certifying agents by legislation. There are movements to increase, to add different qualifying agents. For good reason, but it kind of has to go through its long, tedious course. Some of you are in the room right here, certifying agents. Any medical doctor, they can sign for a person with any disability. A California licensed clinical audiologist can sign only for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. California licensed hearing aid dispenser must have a customer record on file, and may only sign for those people who are deaf or hard of hearing. California licensed optometrist can sign only for people who are blind or partially sighted. California Department of Rehab counselor, VRC, RCB, and RCD can sign for people with any disability. Superintendent of school audiologist at the California School for the Deaf in Riverside or Fremont, only for a current student there. And then the Veterans Administration physician may sign for people with any disability. There's a big movement for speech pathologists. Speech-to-speech is one, a specific type of relay service in its own. If I had a speech disability and I'm not going to be understood by the other person that I'm calling or receiving a call for, I can call through relay service a specific part of that speech to speech, and there is a very highly trained call assistant trained to understand my speech and to translate that call and facilitate the call. But maybe that's the only physician or any kind of professional that I ever see, because I don't go to doctors, I don't have anything else. So there's a movement to have the speech pathologists and people in that field added to the qualifying agent list. Okay, so now, the good news. Okay, the first one is we've been waiting a long time for a replacement for a piece of equipment, a cordless telephone. The Panasonic, some of you remember, was okay. It was cordless, and that was a good thing. There's advantages to having cordless telephones. But there was a Panasonic in the program that had some challenges with it, but it was cordless. Well, that got discontinued by the manufacturer. And we didn't have anything else in the program that was as good or better, because nothing really existed out there that we could get into the program. So it's the EPAC committee, the Equipment Program Advisory Committee, it keeps looking for, you know, different devices that can come into the program, but there's certain parameters. You know, can we get enough? You know, does the community, they have to be tested by the community and people at the service center? Is it a piece of junk and it's going to fall apart? It's not worth it. That's not fair to the consumers. So it has to go through this process that I know we want everything right now, but there are processes. So finally, Panasonic made another telephone. And then I will not get into the six reasons why it was delayed about 7 months. It is now available, and it should be out on the table when the CTAP outreach specialist is out there. And it's black. It is a cordless, so both the base and the handset are speakerphones, can be used as speakerphone. It is also hearing aid compatible and comfortable on the ear for those that use a hearing aid. It does have some volume control. The buttons on both the handset and the base are comfortable, raised, rubberized keys. They're not too big for low vision. They're good where you could just move your fingers, the 10 key, just dialing. So, but they're not too small for if you don't have good dexterity. So it's a nice keypad. The talking features it has is talking caller ID. Every single month I see in the report, blind or low vision community, 85 people want a talking caller ID. Well, that piece of equipment in itself was always turned down because it's not a telecommunications device. So it couldn't be brought in. So now that they're making phones with the talking caller IDs, now we're starting to get them. So we have a couple. This is one. The model number, okay, I didn't know if you wanted all that. That's right, this is on tape, so that'll be good. It is a Panasonic KX-T like Tom, G like George, 2386B like Black, cordless Panasonic. KX-TG2386B. The talking features include the dial keypad, caller ID, phone directory. I think it has like 50, I'm not sure, for the phone directory. Easy to feel keypad buttons on the base and the cordless handset. Speakerphone on both. The locator button. It has digital answering machine with slow talk message playback for easier note taking. I use the message service, but those that want to use the answering in this, the digital answering machine, it'll play back slow but not distort it, so it's easier to take notes. The handheld can clip on your belt or pocket, and it has the port for a headset, which is very important to me. The memory stores up to 50 names and numbers, has the volume, tone, and pulse controls. It can be shipped UPS. I got mine in like the second day. Or you can drop into one of the 7 service centers. Or call, I'm going to say this number a couple of times, 1-800-806-1191. That's a call center number in Stockton. That's pretty much your whatever I need, if I need a different phone or I need somebody to come out. Now for demonstrations, like to your group, to your chapter, that's another number. But 1-800-806-1191. Okay, so the next one is the Talk 500 corded talking phone. It is not out yet. It went to the PUC. It went through my board. It went to the PUC. Once it's approved, then it has to go through its testing, get the equipment in, stocked, and then go out. So approximately 3 months, but, you know, things always change. So those are for people that don't need a cordless. It does have the larger buttons. It does have the talking caller ID. Again, call 1-800-806-1191. It has a fairly large screen, and it comes in 4 languages. I believe English, Spanish, French, and Italian. Again, it's not out yet, but call. Okay, third. Who wants to know about wireless devices or cell phones? Okay, I'll let Jeff. No, I'm kidding. Okay, the wireless phones. It's not as easy as it sounds. I know we wanted it 5 years ago. It was always in legislation. Didn't allow a wireless device. It's just how they wanted to interpret it at the time. It says basic telecommunications. Well, we know a cell phone's not basic. Anyway, we started, not sure how many months ago, actually phase one of the wireless devices testing process. In somehow the way the law is set up, we have to go through this testing process. It's not really testing the device. It's testing this whole new segment of the program that doesn't exist. we have all these tiny parameters over how we get a piece of equipment into the program, and then it's yours for loan, and then it comes back to us when you don't need it anymore, you want to exchange it. The cell phones are different, so it's a whole different way of doing it. So for it to be manageable, because we know just about everybody needs a wireless device, they have to do it in pieces. They thought, well, we need to start with one user group first. The first user group is the deaf community and speech disabled, those that need a handheld paging text device because they're not going to... So voice minutes aren't on this at all. Service isn't paid by the state anyway. But this is not for voice. It's for doing the paging, and there's a lot of features on that. That went through the process of finding people to apply, and they're almost ready to distribute them. The whole wireless thing, here's the rub. Here's the part that nobody likes. This is where the commission added to our proposal. They added a second qualification. The qualification is for low income. Now, our program is based on functional equivalence, not income. We couldn't do anything about it, so you have to be dual qualified for the wireless trial period. Once it's actual equipment in the program, which will take a while, hopefully that's all going to go away. But there was somebody else's agenda needed that in there. So the one phase, they've gone through the application. They found, believe it or not, very few people who actually, less numbers than they thought would qualify for the sidekick because you had to be duly certified. And there were things that were holding them back from applying. Okay, so now the four pieces of equipment for this phase two includes actually four user groups. It includes blind, low vision, cognitive, and manipulation or mobility impairment. They are the two jitterbug phones, the 3-button and the 10-button jitterbug, and at least one or a couple of people have a jitterbug here today. Lots of people have jitterbug. Say me if you have a 3-button jitterbug.
Me.
Okay. Say me if you have a 10-button jitterbug. Okay. So you have a 3-button jitterbug. Okay. The other two pieces are the LG, the Verizon LG phones. They are the Verizon LG VX8350. And LG 8630 coupe, and then the two jitterbugs. Yes, I'll repeat that. The two jitterbugs are the 3-button and the 10-button jitterbug. They have easy to feel buttons, and there's a live operator where you can choose to have your address put in there and just say call Joe, and it can work that way. Then the Verizon LG 8630 coupe, like Coupe de Ville, and LG VX8350. And I'm not going to go into deep detail about all the features on the phones because some of you already know, but I'm not here to talk deeply about those. I will talk about that. Jenny was here from the Lighthouse. And there are two, for this trial period, remember it's just a trial period, there are two agencies that have applied to be the test, to assist with teaching, instructing, helping out with how to use the phone. We all know that we've gone to the phone stores and they're not familiar with how our talking features work or any of that. So we knew that there needs to be, you know, accessibility to how to use our devices. So the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco and the San Diego Center for the Blind have both applied to be the center where you can walk in and get your device, and then they're available to you to go through the features and getting familiar with how they work. It isn't in Central California. It isn't anywhere else. Remember, it's the trial period. So don't worry about it, the phones not being available anywhere else. Okay, and the fourth piece of information, one of our service centers has moved. The Fresno Service Center moved from one location to another location that's fairly new. When I made my notes, it hadn't moved yet, but it has gone. Okay, so those are the good things. Okay, I will tell you where the service center is. Good question. Thank you. The website is www.ddtp.org. DD for deaf and disabled, TP for telecommunications program.org. And by the way, we've secured a bunch of people to check the website. So if you are on the website and you find any part of that website is not accessible or easy to maneuver, let me know and I'll put you in touch with the person that's checking that. The service centers, Fresno, of course, and Oakland, and Sacramento, Burbank, Riverside, and Santa Ana, and San Diego. So Fresno's new address is 7525 North Cedar Avenue. Sacramento's address is 2033 Howe Avenue, Suite 150. Cross street is Cottage Avenue. The Oakland Service Center is 1970 Broadway, Suite 650. The Burbank Service Center is 303 North Glen Oaks Boulevard, Suite L-130. And Riverside is 6370 Magnolia Avenue, Suite 310. And Santa Ana is 2677 North Main Street, Suite 130. And San Diego is 2878 Camino del Rio South, Suite 400. It's a half mile east of Texas Street in San Diego. Okay, one of the challenges, because now I'm going to talk about challenges, and if you don't like something, the program needs to know about it. But the service center didn't tell anybody that it moved. So what could have happened is you could have shown up on a bus or paratransit or a driver, and you don't know that they moved. They had a grand opening, they advised later, and had maps that weren't clear, so you couldn't read the directions on them. Since I came on the board in 2005, the map to that service center was wrong. And it was on the website, and it's a real challenging address anyway. Just that's the city of Fresno. It says it's on one street, but it's very far, you know, from it. And then it didn't have access from the bus stop through the parking lot. I talked about the access issues, and they were under contract, under lease by the real estate division of DGS, and then they realized, whoops, we're not in lease anymore. Anyway, finally they moved. But there's still some access problems to the new location. The parking lot isn't up to ADA code. We're getting reports about the San Diego office. I don't know if any of you ever go into the San Diego Service Center, but for any of the seven service centers, if you encounter access problems, access issues, ADA-type issues, who would you call? That's a challenge. There's not an ADA coordinator I've identified. Another barrier that I'm hearing a lot, and I think some of you may have found this out, that they're running ads for the program. Our marketing department, all of that stuff is supposed to come through the committees, give our advisement on it, what's culturally good, culturally correct for our user group. And so we had we had great brainstorming sessions where all three committees got together and gave all these ideas of what would be great in a TV ad. So they did a wonderful job at coming up with this 30-second thing that was very entertaining, would catch your attention and everything. And I said over and over, think old-time radio, audio, you know, vote, anything you say needs to describe, you know, I kept saying, talk old-time radio. Yeah, think about that. And so now they have a TV ad that has no audible contact information. And some of you have already found that out at the end of when they ran it before. And now it just finished last week, and we were not told that it was running. In fact, I was told there are no more TV ads, just newspaper. So I found it in my paper. But then I heard that last line three times. They called the TV station. It ran again. The TV ad ran again with no contact information. That's where your service charge is going. Anyway, if you want to, if you don't say something about it, they keep saying it doesn't matter. In fact, the response from the marketing department was, I'm sure you agree, Annette, that these are totally accessible. In other words, blind people do not watch TV. They listen to radio, so the radio ads are accessible. Okay, I'm going to take your question. I'm going to try to go by these really quick, the points, and then I'll tell you who to contact. There's the TV ads, the brochures, the maps. Some maps are not correct. I don't know if you would know that, but I found it out that I was asked my opinion, because I'm on the advisory board, we should be getting these things, but on the side, I was asked my opinion about a large print brochure, and I had two pages full of things that I suggested change, that was not a good large print brochure. There was two pages of reasons why it was not, but it never got changed. So there's those. The customer service reps, there's ADA issues and there's just customer service, but there are two things. When you call up the call center, which is in Stockton, that's 1-800-806-1191. That's the main number you would call if you want a telephone or something like that, 1-800-806-1191. And you get told, like, this is that's not for, if the talking caller ID feature goes out on the phone, you can't have another one because that's not really for blind, that's for mobility impaired. I said, well, it's the talking phone with the talking features and the talking. So they already know, the program already knows they're having trouble with the training of the customer service reps. They're contracted, so they already know that, but they don't know the ADA part of it. When I say I want an audio user guide, that's not logged as an ADA thing, so there's no column for customer requested a user guide. So I say, well, who do you call? And there is a consumer affairs department for the PUC. There's a consumer affairs department for the DDTP. DDTP is the Deaf and Disabled Telecommunications Program I advise. The PUC is the, you know, Public Utilities Commission. Of course, it should go first to our consumer affairs, but we don't have an ADA coordinator. We don't have a grievance process. We don't have an ADA notice. A survey that I put in a request. Actually, TADAC, my board, put in a proposal to the Public Utilities Commission to hire an ADA coordinator / an access specialist, somebody that is going to understand these requests that you're asking. We'll at least log them, know how to respond, and then the process to have a timely response to it. We haven't gotten anything. We've gotten all kinds of reasons why they're not going to, but they didn't formally respond to the written proposal. I'm going to give you the number of the consumer affairs number, and I'm going to give you his name. His name is Dan Carbone, C-A-R-B-O-N-E, and he's a great guy. He now realizes, oh, yeah, of course I'm not an access specialist. Oh, yeah, ADA. So it's slightly familiar, the word ADA, but it's not built into his department. So he would be relieved, and I think a lot of the DDTP would be relieved if they actually had an ADA coordinator. So his number is 1-877-546-7414. That's not his direct line, but you know, you ask for the head of the department or Dan Carbone, you're going to get him. 877-546-7414. If you believe it's an ADA issue, state that and say, please log it this way. Then I'll see it, and so will the rest of the commission. We'll see it as an ADA issue. I already gave you the call center number, 1-800-806-1191. The Public Utilities Commission also has the Consumer Affairs Branch. That number is 800-649-7470. When I called it, I got no answer. I don't know if you've ever called it, but I haven't. I got no answer. It rang. But I'll give it again, 800-649-7470. I pressed the option for English, and it just rang, and then I tried not pressing, just letting it go, and it rang. On the website of the DDTP, there's no access person. Then I go to the PUC website, and it says if you want to talk about access to the program for disability access, it's specific, and then it leads you to nowhere because there's just nowhere to go. So it actually has like a link that goes nowhere. So if you are having any barrier to the problem, you want your voice heard, because I keep getting the frustrating, well, who's making these complaints? Well, who? I don't hear it from anybody. So if you are finding a barrier, then you want your voice heard. And I'll entertain any questions.
Jeff suggests, because we know there's a lot of questions. I know Jane had a question for Annette that perhaps... That what we're going to do is, when we conclude this, that if everyone could come up to front and talk to Annette, because we need to get the nominating committee to convene its session almost immediately, because there's a lot of people here who want a lot of information. Annette gave us an incredible report. This is something that I think should be put condensed and put into the BC. It's such a valuable information we did receive, and thank you very much for coming this evening.
Thank you.
If there's no objections, the general session is adjourned. Good evening.